Tomorrow is Election Day in parts of South Florida. We'll go over the races and referenda on the ballot. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are races in Miami, Miami Beach, Hialeah, Homestead, and parts of Monroe County. We're joined by a panel of reporters to get the latest before tomorrow's vote. Also, there's a new collaborative focused on creating more affordable housing throughout the region. The goal is to buy land along the railroad. How much is being invested and how many units will that translate to? And we'll learn about a traveling exhibition on the Holocaust. This one focuses on the rescuers, those who risk their lives to save others. Finally,
the spiritual things, to be real and to be honest, have to be over from the inside.
We remember the iconic mystic and television host, Walter Mercado. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Tomorrow is Election Day in many parts of South Florida. There are races in Miami Beach, Miami, Hialeah, Homestead, and in Marathon in Monroe County. We're going to look at a few of these races and get you updated before you go to the ballot box. We also have information on voting in our social media so you can find out where and how you can vote tomorrow. I'm joined in studio by WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Danny, it was great to have you.
Great to be here.
Also joining me, Miami Herald reporters Joey Fletches. Joey, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And also covering Miami Beach, Martin Vassallo. Martin, welcome.
Thank you.
Vassallo, excuse me. Thank you so much. I appreciate everybody being here today. And again, just to mention that we'll have that information up on our social media so you can find out where to vote or how to vote if you are already registered. Again, the election is tomorrow. Danny, let's start with District 1, Miami City Commission, District 1. First of all, describe the district. What does that cover?
So it's a pretty sprawled out district. It starts... It covers the area around the health district, around Jackson Hospital, and it also goes through Alapata neighborhood, Grapeland Heights, and then some sections of Flagami going out towards the west. And it does border a section that could be impacted by Melrose Park, where a soccer stadium might or might not be going, depending on what the commission decides to do.
And this is a seat that's being vacated because of term limits.
That's exactly right. Commissioner Willie Gort, he's termed out, and now we have seven people going for that seat.
Is there a leading candidate right now? Is there one candidate you say has the leg up on this?
A little bit hard to parse through all the way because there are so many candidates, but the candidate that's looked at as being on the top right now is Alex Diaz de la Portilla. He's a long-term face in Florida politics, not only local politics. He served in the Florida House, the Florida Senate. He was the Senate president for 2 years in the early 2000s. And in the last couple of years, he's ran for several seats, and he's lost all of those. That was a house seat, a county commission seat, and another Florida Senate seat.
He also has some controversies that have been following him around.
He has many controversies that have been following around. He denies all of them and says that it's people just trying to ruffle feathers because he is ahead. He's him or people close to him that he's hired to some capacity have been accused of voter intimidation, from the county commission race that he ran in last year. Some text messages were leaked, where people connected to his campaign were joking about throwing out ballots that were for absentee ballots that were casted for his opponents. He denies all of this and says that it's all pretty much made up.
One of his opponents, one of the seven candidates, is Horacio Stewart Aguirre. He's got a link to President Trump and to Governor DeSantis.
He does. Horacio's sister is actually the current spokesperson for Governor Ron DeSantis, Helen Ferre, and she was also she also worked with President Trump in the earlier part of his presidency.
All right, I said that wrong, and I do apologize. Horacio, is that what you just say? Horacio, or how's his name?
Horacio.
Okay, perfect. I just want to make sure I get that right. I don't want to mispronounce anybody's name before the election. There's another candidate who's also a very interesting name in this because he's a newcomer, Eleazar Melendez.
That's right.
He was a journalist.
He was a journalist at some point, and then he became part of of Commissioner Ken Russell, who is also going up for election. We'll talk about him in a minute. He was part of his office as a chief of staff for 2 years. He's very close with Commissioner Russell. Commissioner Russell's political arm even gave his campaign $150,000 to run. So, you know, Melendez is running his own campaign, but it's also those two seats are somewhat tied together because what voters will be looking at is if both Ken Russell wins a re-election and if Melendez gets in there, then you would have a somewhat progressive city commission for, I would say, the first time ever. I mean, I don't know how far back we go, but the makeup of the city commission would drastically be changed if those two were to win.
There is one candidate that wants to sue the county, right?
there's an interesting character who's running, Frank Pichel. He's been a long-term chair of the code enforcement board. And he says if he wins re-election, the first thing he's going to do is he's going to steal a trolley and then start driving it around and then sue Miami-Dade County. He's very upset that the county eliminated a bus route that runs through Alapata. He feels like the Alapata neighborhood is getting the short end of the stick when it comes to the county and how they're giving money for transit, and he wants to reverse that.
You got to moderate a debate with these candidates not that long ago. So what was the takeaway from that?
I would say it's a lot of people, and I wouldn't be surprised if this goes to a runoff.
And if that does, then what happens?
Well, then a couple of weeks from now, there'd be a runoff election, and we would see who is on the top of that pile. I could be wrong on that. We could have a walkaway winner tomorrow, but it's... With seven candidates on a, there's no incumbent. It could happen.
That's Miami seat commission, or seat one, district one, I should say, for the Miami City Commission. Again, talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivera. All right, let's switch over now and take a look at district two, because he did mention that if one of the candidates wins and then you have the incumbent in district two win, that kind of reshapes maybe the whole commission. Let's see. Again, District 2, we got four candidates. Ken Russell is the incumbent. Joining me now, Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletches. Joey, remind us of what District 2 covers.
District 2 stretches from Coconut Grove up to Morningside along the Miami's waterfront. That includes downtown and Brickell. So it's the most affluent district in the city, the most densely populated, and it has some unique problems to it. Because of that.
All right, Russell is the incumbent, but I mean, how do people feel about him and what he's done up to this point?
Depends on who you ask, you know, and I'm interested to see what the results of this election are, because I think that'll serve as a good indicator of his performance from the voters' perspective. He has some strong supporters who back him on his on some of the issues that he's supported in the past. He wanted to address lot splitting in Coconut Grove. He wanted to create incentives for developers to build affordable housing. And he wanted to, you know, stand up to developers who he thought were overstepping their bounds. And in one case, he did, on city-owned Watson Island, he pushed to evict the developer that had not started a project that was approved more than a decade ago. Some people thought that was a great idea. That did end up costing the city $20 million in a settlement after some litigation. So there's a bit of a jury's out, and this election is going to probably say a lot. I mean, there are four candidates. Russell is the incumbent. If he's taken to a runoff, that's a statement. If he wins outright, that's a statement.
And the other four,
if he loses, it's a statement.
The other three candidates, Jim Freed, mm-hmm. Freed, Javier Gonzalez, and Rosa Maria Palomino. What do we know about these folks?
Jim Freed is a real estate broker, a longtime resident, and he came into the race quite late. Late in August, he filed, and he's seen as sort of the most viable candidate against Ken Russell at this point. He has some strong support coming from some of Russell's biggest critics in downtown in Coconut Grove. So he's raised the second most amount of money. Javier Gonzalez is a repeat candidate. He does have some name ID because he's run a few times before. He's run against Russell in the past, a real estate agent. Who knows? Could surprise you. Rosie Palomino is a Coconut Grove businesswoman who has similarly run several times before, has not really gained a lot of traction in the past. Not sure if she'll be a factor in this, but you know, that's why we vote.
Well, you had a story recently. I mean, looking at I guess some of the bigger issues for this district, and I mean, affordable housing is one, but also the fact that because of where it's located, you know, flooding and sea level rise are a big issue for them. I mean, really, for the district, for the voters, I'm curious as to how big that issue of flooding is and what they expect their elected official to do about it.
That's a good question, because local municipalities have struggled with how to really jump into that conversation without creating problems for themselves. I mean, for example, Miami Beach, and you'll hear a little bit about that when we talk about the beach elections, they decided to spend a lot of money to raise roads and build pumps, but that, you know, that made some people uncomfortable and has thus been paused because when they started to move into neighborhoods, people felt uncomfortable how that could impact their properties. So in the city of Miami, they haven't quite gone there. They passed the Forever Bond a couple of years ago. Voters approved that. But now we're in the stage where they're implementing. So borrowing the money, now how to spend it. And the District 2 commissioner, whoever it is, will have a say in how that money is spent. All the candidates have acknowledged that sea level rise is a problem for District 2. There's some plumbing issues that need to be addressed. They need to figure out drainage in certain areas that involves pumps. But I haven't heard a whole lot of detail, like a lot of nitty-gritty detail about how precisely, other than some broad statements about how there needs to be more parks and more tree canopy. It'll be interesting to see, you know, if there's some more concrete vision coming out of these candidates. I mean, the one thing that they all say is that they know and they have an anticipation that there's going to be displacement along the coast in some of these most vulnerable neighborhoods long term, a phenomenon that's going to be called climate gentrification. That's something Russell even said he didn't believe it at first, but then he looked at it and he sensed that there was more investment on higher ground in Miami.
There was a debate recently. Three of the four candidates showed up. I mean, what was the takeaway from that?
Biggest takeaway there was there's a lot of common ground between these folks, but they do differ in a couple of notable areas. You know, development is one, and housing. Russell believes that the community redevelopment agencies, these sort of mini governments that are formed, they keep tax dollars within their boundaries, can be used properly. These kinds of agencies have faced scrutiny from state agencies before for misspending, for not truly addressing slum and blight, which is what they're supposed to do. The other candidates did not agree with him. They say it's going to be a vehicle for corruption, a vehicle for misspending. But they also do have a lot of common ground, and it makes you wonder, you know, to what extent they're going to create daylight from each other here in the last few weeks.
Four candidates for Miami City Commission District 2. Again, elections tomorrow for a couple seats in Miami, Hialeah, Homestead, Miami Beach, and Marathon. Let's take a look at Miami Beach. Joining me now, Miami Herald reporter Martin Vassolo. Martin, okay, Miami Beach. The mayor is staying in his post, Dan Gelber. He did have candidates, but then what happened? He's now in a post.
Right, and people saw this coming. In 2017, Mayor Gelber won with 82% of the vote. This time around, he was facing two relatively unknown candidates. They dropped out in September. They opted not to pay the qualifying fee, so maybe their internal polling showed that, you know, the incumbent was too strong to battle against.
So Dan Gelber stays as the mayor. Group four, this is you got some drama in this one because you got a few candidates who have a connection to each other. This is Kristen Rosen Gonzalez is running for her old seat because she was running for another office, had to leave. She's linked to two other candidates in a very strange way. Briefly try to explain this drama.
Right. So Kristen Rosen Gonzalez, she ran for Congress unsuccessfully. She's facing off against a former political ally who turned around and sued her for defamation after she accused him. This is Rafael Velasquez, of exposing himself to her on the campaign trail in 2017. He denies it, and most of his platform is running on, you know, clearing his name and trying to, you know, make sure she doesn't get elected.
And one other candidate supposedly is connected to her as well.
Then we have Mike Baranow. He is on the planning board, and his link to her is just that they dated briefly a few years back.
All right. There are five candidates in Group 5 City Commission for Miami Beach. The incumbent is Ricky Arreola. He's got a bit of a reputation.
Right. There's four candidates now.
Four.
One
okay.
dropped out. Yeah.
Okay, four.
Yeah, so Ricky is known for being a little rough around the edges and sticking his neck out for things that he believes in. And he has said this that he doesn't go with the political wave. He'll do what he thinks is right. And his candidates, the candidates running against him, have criticized him for, you know, knowing what the candidate, what residents want, and just kind of, you know, plowing through without taking their considerations into
People have said he's aggressive. Yeah. He's a bit aggressive. There is a group six, four candidates in that. But I wanted to look at this. The voters have six referenda to look at. Two big ones here. Changing the mayor's term limits and the pay for commissioners and for the mayor. Real quickly, what's with the mayor's term limits? What is that agenda?
Right. So that would increase the mayor's term limit from 2 to 4 years. Supporters of that say the mayor shouldn't be in a constant state of reelection and he should have more time to focus on the city. Detractors say that, you know, if commissioners are up for reelection every 2 years, so having the mayor on the ticket kind of brings out more voters. And then in terms of pay, the referendum aims to increase the pay of commissioners from $6,000 to $45,000 and the mayor from $10,000 to $75,000.
This was on before and the voters said no.
Right.
Why bring it back?
So the original form of it would have taken effect immediately. This gives commissioners some time, so it'll take effect in 2021.
Martin Vassallo, reporter with the Miami Herald, want to mention real quickly again that there are elections in a lot of other places. He's covering Miami Beach. Again, a number of races there, referenda to cover. Miami City Commission, District 1 and 2. Also want to mention there are elections in Homestead, two candidates running for mayor. Two seats, seat 2 and seat 3, are open. In Hialeah, you have more than a dozen. Actually, it's 13 candidates vying for four seats. There are also four referenda on that ballot. And in Marathon, there are three city council seats that are currently vacant and up for your vote. Again, more details about these races, we'll post those up on our social media, Facebook or Twitter, at WLRN Sundell. So if you are voting tomorrow, get to know your candidates, get to know what these agenda items are. Gentlemen, I really appreciate the time as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, still to come, a new initiative in South Florida to create more affordable housing. But how will it work? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. There's a new project aimed at building hundreds of affordable housing units along the Florida East Coast Railroad train tracks. That's where the Brightline train runs. It's called South Florida's Housing Link Collaborative. It's a partnership between nonprofit groups in the region. All of the affordable housing units are to be built with climate change resistant designs and materials. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company has invested $5 million to the project. And the South Florida Community Land Trust is a partner in this. Mandy Bartle is the executive director of the Land Trust, and she joins me now. Mandy Bartle, great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
This, when this came out, I mean, it's a big deal because we keep talking about the issue of affordable housing, the lack of it in South Florida. How did this housing collaborative even get started?
Yeah, thank you. And this gives me a perfect opportunity to share with you some of the partners in the collaborative. So the South Florida Housing Link exists with two affordable housing directors or housing developers. South Florida Community Land Trust is, of course, one of them, as well as the CLT of Palm Beach County. And we have two community lenders, which is Solar Energy Loan Fund, Florida Community Loan Fund, and Enterprise Community Partners. So together, this group really came together with a really important mission, which was to find a way to make sure that people currently living and working in our communities can afford to stay and share in the success of our region.
I mean, as you know, South Florida residents are getting priced out. This region ranks as one of the most cost-burdened places to live in the country. When did you start to notice that need for affordable housing here?
Well, it's obvious to everyone living in our community. And one of the things that really sets this initiative apart is the fact that it's located close to transit. So here in South Florida, when you start to count housing and transit expenses together, a lot of our working poor families are spending almost 70 cents on every dollar that they earn. So that really leaves very little to do other things. So this initiative is really aimed at targeting multiple issues all at the same time.
All right, let's take a look at how this is going to work. There's an initial investment from JP Morgan Chase. How is that money going to be spent? Or it's $5 million, which I think on the outside it looks like, well, that's not much, but that's supposed to help bring in more money. But how is this initiative supposed to work?
So the $5 million is actually going to be catalyzed into $75 million worth of targeted investments on this corridor. And our plan's really simple. We're going to acquire vacant land and existing apartment buildings that are in need of renovation. We're going to build new and renovate older buildings with hurricane resilient and energy efficient design. And then we're going to hold all of those properties in a community land trust, which means the nonprofit is going to maintain the land rights and protect the affordability forever.
All of this, by the way, takes place near, it has to be near the railroad tracks, near the Brightline stations, near the Brightline line. Why that? Why build it around that area? Why focus on just that area?
Yeah, so there was a couple things that we were considering. So when you look at that transit corridor, most importantly, it links South Florida together with a common history, economy, geography from Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties. And within that corridor itself, we have a lot of low-income renters. And we're also noticing that there's really high investment happening, and it's really elevated with the recent addition of the commuter rail along this line. And the third reason is that this happens to be the highest ground here in South Florida. So quite literally, we are protecting the vulnerable, which are those that are low income and renting, from displacement, and we're placing them in some of the highest ground or the safest communities to be resistant to some of the climate change.
So this is part of a lot of conversations that we have, obviously. You talk about those communities, the higher ground. That is rapidly becoming, you know, gold for developers because higher ground, that's better in the decades to come, obviously. How will this initiative protect those communities from developers coming in and saying, we'll give you a bunch of money because we could put lots of high rises here?
Yeah, that's what we're seeing happen right now. And so this is really a counter to that and making sure we're building for the people living there. And the community land trust is really the key to protecting affordability. It's a nonprofit organization that's making a promise that it's not going to stay affordable just for a year or two or 10 years or 30 years, but it's going to stay affordable forever and for generations to come.
I'm speaking with Mandy Bartle. She's the CEO of the South Florida Community Land Trust. The Land Trust is a partner in this new South Florida's Housing Link Collaborative. This is a project that will build hundreds of affordable housing units along the Brightline train tracks. You can get more information on our Facebook or Twitter. Just look up WLRN Sundial. There is an environmental component to this that you mentioned a second ago. All of these housing units will be built, the new ones, with climate-resistant design and materials. Those that are going to be refurbished or rebuilt will also get this. Describe what that means exactly, what the resistance is.
Yeah, so this is really addressing our current issues with long-term solutions. So the Community Land Trust looks long-term for affordable housing, but by incorporating sustainable design, we're making sure that these homes will be around for the long term. So we're focusing on older apartment buildings, primarily those built before 1996, which was the older building codes. And we're partnering with groups and community lenders that are also going to be making similar investments for home buyers to make improvements to their house as well.
Now, is the initial investment that goes into building that resiliency, or is that something separate?
Yeah, it's definitely going to help and contribute and leverage up to that $75 million worth of total investments. We're going to target some of the initial dollars on acquisition, and then we're going to partner with the community lenders to provide financing to do those energy and resilient improvements.
So we see the development in Miami and throughout South Florida, and it's a lot of high-end luxury homes and condos that are being built. How do you define affordable housing, just so that we at least set the standard here? What does that mean?
Yeah, and, you know, everyone talks about it a little bit differently. We look at it as not spending more than 30% of your income on housing costs. And so really, when you think about it in those terms, there's people across all incomes and all spectrums that really need affordable housing because our costs are so high down here.
Have you seen this in other cities or maybe even in other countries that we could point to and say, this is how it should work here?
Yeah, so we've seen a couple great examples of other communities locating affordable housing near transit. Denver, for example, Atlanta with the Beltline that's getting developed right now.
Right.
So there's certainly communities that we look to, and we want to deploy a similar strategy here in South Florida.
When you look at some of that area, some of the region, I want to know what the criteria is for qualifying for this program. I mean, some of that property, you're just looking for land in some cases, but in others, you've got existing homes. They're not going to go away, but it's about helping those homeowners. But is there a criteria set?
Yeah, let me tell you what we did. So we looked at potential station stops along this FEC line, and we analyzed each one. We mapped out vacant land and older apartment buildings within a half mile of these proposed stations. And second, we started to look at areas where we know investment is coming in. These are opportunity zones, community redevelopment areas, and designations that already exist. And then third, we started to identify walkable areas that have the density to support transit-oriented development. And using those criteria, we identified some of the best opportunities for us to invest in and some of the areas that need affordable housing the most.
What does the schedule look like for, you know, spreading this out, construction, the redevelopment of that area? What do you foresee?
So the landmark investment from JP Morgan Chase goes over a 3-year period, but really we see this initiative going on for the next 5 years and hopefully longer. So our first step is really getting the word out, finding the right partners, hopefully local cities and counties that may own land, and starting to acquire those properties in the next year. Years 2 and 3 will start to renovate the properties, the older apartment buildings, and really start to build some of the new units over the next 4 to 5 years.
Are there plans to go into Broward and Palm Beach County?
Absolutely. This is a regional effort. One of the things that we know is we can't tackle affordable housing as individual communities. We need to tackle it as a region. So this initiative actually cuts through Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties and the communities that go through the FEC corridor.
Is it just the other thing, too, is it about trying to get to where those stations are along the line, hoping there'll be more stations opened? Or do you think this can create more stations along that line to open up?
That's the ultimate chicken and egg scenario, right? So we have to have the density to support the development, but we also need the development to support the density in the new units. There's been plans that exist from both Brightline and Virgin Trains, as well as Tri-Rail, about potential stations that they're looking at and analyzing. And those are some where we started. And so we identified other criteria that we think is important to locate affordable housing and that may support the development of these stations in the future.
Mandy Bartle, again, CEO of the South Florida Community Land Trust. You can find more information about this new affordable housing project in South Florida, because as she said, it's not just a Miami thing. You could go to Facebook or Twitter, look us up at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. What are some of the things you want to see in helping create more affordable housing opportunities in our region? Mandy Bartle, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for helping us understand how this works.
Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, an exhibit that looks at the Holocaust through the eyes of those who rescued Jewish families. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. More than 30 years ago, photographer Gay Block and writer Malka Drucker told a different type of story about the Holocaust. Through hundreds of interviews and poignant, intimate photographs, the two captured the stories of those involved in the rescue efforts during the Holocaust. These were Christian families, teachers, and diplomats from across Europe who risked their lives to save thousands of Jews over the course of the 1930s and 40s. The project, Rescuers, became a book and a traveling exhibition. It debuted at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1992 and traveled to 50 cities across the U.S. over the next 11 years. The exhibit is now back in Boca Raton through December 22nd at the Levis JCC Sandler Center. Gay Block is in town for the opening of the exhibition in Boca and joins me now in studio. Gay Block, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Almost 3 decades since the Rescuers solo exhibition opened in New York. Why bring it back on tour now?
Well, I think a lot of people believe, as well as I do, that our world needs rescuers again, unfortunately. There are people who are suffering, not for the most part because of who they are, not for anything they've done. There might be different ethnically or from a different country. And there's a certain denigration of immigrants these days. It's a very dangerous place to be.
And it's such a strange thing. I mean, whenever we talk about this, I always think about the fact that, I mean, many, many decades ago, we defeated the Nazis. And yet there's still Nazis. There's still this movement. There's still an attack. Anti-Semitism is on the rise.
Unfortunately, we will always have hate among us.
Definitely. The origin story for this project is fascinating. Your partner and writer on the project, again, Malka, was connected with several rescuers in Los Angeles. Were there other stories of rescuers at the time even being discussed in the mainstream media? Was anybody talking about these people?
They weren't, and our rabbi, Harold Schulweis, asked us to do something about it because for 25 years he had tried to get people to pay attention to those who had tried to help Jews during that time. And I said, are they still alive? Can I meet them? And he said, yes, there are some right here in Los Angeles, which is where we all were. And so we began actually with a Polish woman who was visiting someone she had saved in Warsaw, and did the first interview and just thought, these are amazing people. If I could be privileged to sit in front of them and talk to them about what in the world made them realize they could do such a thing, rescue Jews at the risk of their life, I wanted to meet as many of them as I could.
What was it like? Yeah, I wondered if you remember that first rescuer you spoke with, and what was that like hearing that account, hearing those stories?
That first rescuer was a Polish woman who hid Jews in one part of her apartment and guns in another. She was a complete, a fighter against the Nazis in Warsaw. She spoke no English, and one of the women she saved in Staten Island, she was visiting her, and so we interviewed her there, and it was all in translation. I'm a photographer, so the picture I made of her is the way she smoked, because she lit one cigarette from another and exhaled above her head in this carefree, independent way that, to me, captured her energy and what she had done in those times.
There was, I mean, again, so many stories, so I picked out a few. But there was one of a secondary school teacher in Belgium, Andre Herskovici. She rescued Jewish children. First of all, how did she start doing that? How did that story unfold?
She noticed as a teacher that there were children disappearing from her class, her many classes, and she asked, where are they going? Who are they? And found out they were Jewish children who could no longer safely go to school. And so she began placing these Jewish children in Christian homes, because they were in danger. And she placed over 1,000 Jewish children in Brussels.
Were there ever moments when she was at risk because maybe a student saw what she was doing, or somebody saw what she was doing and could have turned her in?
When we asked her that, and it's on the video that I made about them, as she's included, she said, when you're doing something you know you have to do and that's right, fear is in the background.
That's a great way to put that. I wonder, as a photographer, for you, you're hearing these stories, but you're trying to capture an image of a moment of these stories. How do you do that? How did you go about this in this project?
The way that I've always photographed is that I talk to a person I'm going to make a portrait of for a good long while, until we seem to know each other and feel comfortable with each other. And then I simply photograph what I see, who I see, the person that is in front of me. And they feel comfortable showing me who they are. There's very little It's so esoteric. It's very difficult to explain it any better than that.
I'm just always fascinated by the photographer's eye and how they're trying to capture a story. I mean, here I'm talking to people. This is how I capture stories.
Exactly.
Getting you to tell them. There was a controversy about telling these rescuer stories, wasn't there?
Because Jews said, I survived on my own. I never saw a rescuer. And yes, there was fear that the news of rescuers might whitewash, so to speak, the Holocaust, the horrors of the Holocaust. Yes, most people did not see rescuers. They were, as we call them, a raindrop in an ocean of indifference. And yet, their stories deserve books because the example of rescue is so important.
I'm talking with photographer Gabe Block. She and writer Malka Drucker are behind the exhibition Rescuers. It tells the stories of Christian Europeans that risked their lives to save, hide, and protect Jews during the reign of the Nazis. The exhibition just opened at the Levis JCC Sandler Center in Boca Raton, and it runs through December 22nd. By the way, you could see some of those photos and find details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jan Karski. This is another fascinating story. He was a Polish spy. He skied across Slovenia into Hungary for a mission. He was captured by German soldiers, then rescued by the Polish resistance. How did Karski get involved in the effort to save Jews?
He was a Polish diplomat, and as you said, and he just looked around for what could he do. He knew that what was happening was a terrible thing. And so he was asked by some Jews to go into the Warsaw Ghetto and see what was happening, and so that he could then take the news, because he was a diplomat and could do this, to England and to the United States. And he subsequently met with Anthony Eden, who was then before Churchill, and with Roosevelt. And Roosevelt said to him, "We're going to win the war, Karski, but I have no time just saving a few Jews." That was his answer. And so because he was so discouraged by the answers he got, he was asking for help. He stayed in this country and traveled all around, writing a book called Story of a Secret State and giving lectures all over the country about what was happening in Europe, because people didn't really know.
Was that the perspective for the U.S. and the United Kingdom? Was, let's just win the war.
That's right.
We can't save anybody right now. Let's just win the war. Finish this off.
Exactly.
His photograph is also, I mean, all the photographs are absolutely beautiful, but there was something about looking at his picture. There's a confidence in the way he sits there. I don't know, but what was your take on you know, his presence?
I can't even describe Karski because he's so complex. He could laugh almost in a childish way. He was brilliant. He was a teacher at Georgetown for the rest of his career. Once he got to this country in 1943, traveled around and wrote a book. As I said, he couldn't go back to Poland. And so he was just brilliant, as well as being very human. And after the book was published, we went to Washington, where he lived, and he went with us to bookstores and radio stations and appeared with us. He was a very generous, loving man.
Another incredible story. I could pick out so many, but this one I wanted. Arnold Dowis, I hope I'm saying this right.
Exactly.
Was originally deported from the United States for giving food to a black man and being labeled as a communist. What was his involvement in the resistance?
He worked with he was from a small town in the Netherlands called Nulanda, which in the end was honored by Yad Vashem, the Holocaust memorial in Jerusalem, which honors rescuers, people who helped Jews. He was going into Amsterdam. He was Dutch, going into Amsterdam, taking as many Jews out as he could, saying to them, "Come with me. I have a warm place for you to sleep. Lots of food." He said, "I lied to everybody, but I had to get them out of Amsterdam because the Nazis had made all Jews go to Amsterdam out of the rest of the country so that they would more easily be able to round them up. So he placed them in many, many different places.
Did any of the rescuers mention if any of the survivor families, if they had stayed in touch?
Yes. Some of the rescuers talked about how they didn't feel that the Jews had thanked them after the war. And another survivor said, this was being taught to children, and the children said, how could the Jews not thank the people, someone who saved them? And a person, another survivor of the war, came to talk to the children and said, you have to understand, even if you're thanking someone who saved your life, it's going to put you back in memory in this time when you were nothing but a victim, and your life was so dangerous for you, you do not want to think about that time again, no matter what.
Something, just a perspective I had never thought of. The generation of survivors is rapidly aging out. Of the survivors, are there individuals that you still stay in touch with? Of these rescuers, by the way.
Rescuers, yeah. Yes. Because I never really met survivors formally,
the rescuers,
anyway.
Yeah.
No, they are not still alive. And as far as I know, there aren't any. Mm. And I did keep in touch with many, certainly in this country, until they died.
We are reaching that point where we're losing that generation very quickly.
Absolutely.
The other thing, too, is this. I mean, considering, again, that the exhibit has toured across the country, and it was, again, decades ago. What does it mean for you to see it back again now, back on tour?
What I think of today is, unfortunately, as I think I've said, we are in need of rescuers again today, because there is hatred of the other that exists in our country and worldwide that is so unnecessary. It seems to me that if you set out to meet people who are different from you, or if we all do, who are different from us, we will understand that their difference is not a negative thing. It's instead something that can help us grow as a human being, to know different kinds of people in the world.
You got to speak to some folks in Boca recently about, you know, the exhibit.
Yes.
And I wondered what some of the things they told you. I wonder, too, if younger generations, you know, also got to speak to you, because I want to know how they've been impacted by these stories.
I don't actually. Yes, I think younger generations are, you know, not the least bit informed about that time, World War II.
Yeah.
That's the value in resurrecting these stories now, because they don't know anything about, certainly, even what the Nazis did, much less what people who are trying to save. And of course, if you were a rescuer, you were as much at risk as a Jew. And in especially a country like Poland, if they caught a rescuer hiding a Jew, they would hang both the rescuer and the Jew in a public place in a Polish town. It was very dangerous to be a rescuer.
What did you hear from people, though? Because, again, you were speaking to some folks in Boca recently, right, for the exhibit. What did you hear from them?
I'm not exactly sure what you're
looking for. No, I mean,
you
get the chance to meet with some folks, though, for the exhibit, right? I mean,
right.
I just want to know what people are saying about it right now.
Well, they're saying that our times warrant this exhibit coming again, that we... there are leaders in the world, and I believe in this country that Trump is one of those leaders who are generating hatred of the other, talking about immigrants as if they are less than we, which, of course, I don't believe at all.
Mm.
They may be in danger, but they're not less people, less as a person.
I've been talking with photographer Gabe Block. She and Malka Drucker are behind the exhibition called Rescuers. It just opened at the Levis JCC Sandler Center in Boca Raton. It runs through December 22nd. Again, fascinating stories, beautiful pictures. You could see some of the photos and get more details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Gabe Block, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing all this.
Thank you for your interest very much.
And if you do get the chance to go see the exhibit, please find us on social media. Let us know what you think. Now, I want to take a moment to remember a figure who has a deep connection with a lot of people here in South Florida. Walter Mercado, the legendary Puerto Rican astrologer who has shared his daily horoscopes and readings for years, passed away at his home in Puerto Rico this weekend. He was 87. We spoke to him back in August at the History of Miami Museum about his career. The museum had a month-long exhibition celebrating his life.
The spiritual things, to be real and to be honest, have to be over from the inside to outside. Since I was very, very little, I have revelations, visions. And then the people follow me so I can touch them for good luck or for health. I touch, lady, you have a problem. Yes, I have this leg. Yes, and then I touch. And later on, thank you, Walter. Right now I'm in perfect condition. But I'm always giving that touch of love. And they believe that that touch of love makes miracles. That's why they call me Walter of the Miracles at that time. But many years, can you imagine? And you're giving this chart, this conversation in radio. And I live in the radio. Sometimes I pass from 8 in the morning to 8 at night, all the time in the radio station.
In, you know, the work that you've done on your show, as you know, talking to people about astrology, about their lives.
I let what I have inside, what I gave to the people who came to me. I always say, if you are full of love, you have to forget the past. The past is carrying like a burden of sometimes of guilty things and guilty and anger. Forget it. Forget about the future. God is going to plan for you. Enjoy the moment now. The beautiful moment you are living here and now. That's the only way to live. Enjoy, but in a very intense, passionate way, you are today. Every morning when I wake up late, because I'm a little, like to sleep a lot, at 10, 11, I first of all I say, thank you, God. Thank you, Mother God. Thank you for one day that I'm going to live as I feel. And I'm going to give the best of myself to everybody that I find in my way through my life.
And this is what you've been famous for. A big part of it is your outfits, your capes, so much of what you own.
This angel, Karim, began to look around to the most strange and for me quite important, like my first castanet, my first pack of tarot cards, my first everything. So he entered at my home, and I love him. He's a genius. And he choosing, and he makes me remember all those moments in my life when I was beginning to dance with the castanet in a stage, and when I was reading the tarot, and the people everywhere, Walter, please read what the tarot said about me. And all the things, he was taking something for the people to know that Walter is not only the cape or the hair of what they think. I have in the world, there are 5 persons, the most imitated ones. One is Julio Iglesias, the other Michael Jackson, but the first one is Walter Mercado. Imitation in Colombia, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Spain, they put a wig and a cape, and then ha, paz y amor, and that, and I laugh a lot. If they enjoy it, go on doing it.
That was legendary Puerto Rican astrologer Walter Mercado. You heard him, by the way, mention Kareem. That's Kareem Tapsch of O Cinema, who's been working on a documentary about Walter's life. We'll have more on that to come. Walter Mercado died this weekend at the age of 87 from health complications. You can read more about Walter's life and see photos from his exhibition by going to WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Monday, November 4th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, there's a new special series coming out from WNYC in partnership with us, WLRN. Their show, The Stakes, came down to South Florida to examine the effects of gentrification on neighborhoods throughout Miami. WLRN reporter Nadege Green explores how climate is making gentrification worse and how folks are responding. Then we're going to hear from Miami-Dade County Resiliency Officer Jane Gilbert about how the county is protecting the most vulnerable communities to climate change. And finally, the film Cuba kicked off the Fort Lauderdale Film Festival. It's a love story to the country through the ballet, classic American cars, and its coral reefs. We're going to speak with director Peter Chang. This is WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, thank you so much for listening. Find us online, WLRN.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Always love to hear what you think of the program. And don't forget, we're a podcast. Find us on iTunes. You can listen when you'd love. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.